Media connoisseur Mario Garcia tells us why we should all be optimistic about journalism in 2019. Plus, from Taiwan, the editor of White Fungus talks about the protest publication roots of his magazine, and we'll make time for a detour to visit the freshly relocated and legendary British travel bookshop Stanford's. That's what's in store this week on The Stack. From Midori House in London, this is The Stack, 30 minutes of print industry analysis with me, Tom Edwards. Coming up a little later, we'll speak to Ron Hansen, editor of White Fungus, and pay a visit to the new Stanford's here in London. But we start with Monocle friend and CEO of Garcia Media, Dr. Mario Garcia. Garcia is very optimistic about journalism in 2019 and beyond, and he had some delightfully encouraging words on exactly why he feels this is the case. Here he is, speaking to The Stack's Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
Well, I'm optimistic usually as a person, and I think that this is how I survived in this business so long, and where other people see a crisis, or where a lot of people, specifically the older editors, lament the way it was, I celebrate the way it is. And I think that, why are we celebrating? Well, more people are reading what we produce than ever before. We have at least five platforms in which to present our journalism. I mean, the five platforms, you can get snippets of information on your watch. You have the phone, which is the most important one, I think. You have print still, and you will have print for years to come. You have the tablet, and you have online editions that you read on your laptop. Now the sixth platform is already becoming, you know, you put your glasses on and you can have virtual reality, stories that are told differently. So why are we optimistic? Because if you are storyteller like I am, like journalists trained to be storytellers, now you can tell stories in so many different ways. And so I'm fascinated. This is the busiest I have been since 1992, when I was putting color into so many newspapers. And that was a revolution, you know, black and white newspapers turning to color. This is the biggest revolution I have seen, because it cuts into journalism itself, how we tell stories, how we edit, how we design, how we write for the smallest of all platforms, which is where a lot of people are consuming their information, on the phone. And so it requires gymnastics that make the journalist think. And what time of the day will my story appear? We are in the culture now of, you follow the story first, and not so much the editions. Edition, journalists think in terms of edition. Tomorrow's newspaper, TV journalist, tonight's broadcast. In today's environment, the best newsrooms are the ones where you have people who follow the stories. The stories is the center of the universe. Some stories have long legs, some stories have short legs, but people are reading those stories and coming back to those stories 10, 15 times a day. The average millennial comes to the phone 114 times in a day. So you have great possibilities to not only present the story, but to follow up the story, to engage with the readers in the story. That's why I'm optimistic.
I love that, Mario. And I have to be honest, I share your optimism as well. And you mentioned that you've been as busy as you've ever been before. Perhaps you could share some of your projects that you're working at the moment.
Absolutely. Obviously, I have been known as a designer for 45 years in this business. But a lot of what I do right now has less to do with the design itself, and it has more to do with change, transformation, creating an environment in the newsroom where people begin to change the way they work, the hours at which things happen, abandoning these large meetings where people look at their phones and they are not concentrated, and having shorter meetings but more times in the day where people workshop the stories. So I am working in the transformation projects in Berlin, for example, with the Tagesspiegel. I am working with a group of 79 regional newspapers in the northern part of Germany with the NOS Digital group, helping with the transformation of Courier in Austria, working with some of the special niche publications of the Financial Times in New York. And at the same time, doing work with corporate communications, because corporate communications is also interested in communicating to their internally and externally on the phone. So again, a vibrant time to deal with storytelling. And so that's why, you know, I'm busy, and I teach my class at Columbia University. So I teach multi-platform design and storytelling at the graduate school of Columbia University. So busy, busy is the word, but everything is nice. And when you make progress in a newsroom, when you get there and you do a workshop on how to write stories for mobile, and the way I do it is I begin by telling, can you select a story you have done in the last 7 days, which was consumed a lot on the phone, but was created for print perhaps, or even for online? How can we in 2 hours transform that story once we learn how to be a linear visual story that is tailored precisely to be consumed on the phone? When you see how these people take to this, that's what keeps me going. That's why I'm going to be 72 years old, but it keeps me going because it makes you feel 29 when you see this.
That's amazing. And Mario, of course, you work with so many international papers, including some from my home country, Brazil. And you're saying, of course, the media has been through difficult times. But even, for example, a country like Brazil, which is, you know, we had a tough economic crisis. But I think papers are such, they're so relevant in the current climate as well. Wouldn't you agree?
Oh, absolutely. Part of what really makes me optimistic about journalism is that at a time when you have an environment perhaps where people at the top who are governing are so anti-media, people realize that newspapers, that good journalism is the best friend of democracy. Whatever you believe in, I am not into a discussion of who you like or who you don't. In your own country, you now have a president who is very different from the ones who came before him. He was elected. Some people like him. So the press is going to keep an eye on a president like this. Just like in the US, the press is really doing a fantastic job in presenting both sides of the equation to really face the Trump era, you know, where sometimes President Trump will tell you that what you read in the press is fake news. Well, the press is there to present both sides of the story, or the side of the story that perhaps you don't hear. So when we're talking about good journalism, is people are reading more, people are connected more. Again, Fernando, I go back to the point, if you, in the era of print newspapers and television, you read your news at 7 o'clock in the morning with your coffee, and then the news left you for 18 hours, and then maybe at 6 o'clock you watch the television news or before you went to bed. In today's environment, as long as you have a phone in your hand, the news is forever with you. And the good newsrooms are aware of this. And so if I come to my phone 75 times a day, which I may do that, it is 75 opportunities for the brand of a media house to be in front of me and to update stories for me. So one day in the mobile first era could be 60, 70 days of the calendar in the days when you only had a printed newspaper. That is not terrific. What is?
Exactly. And what about, just being a bit more old-fashioned, what about the world of magazines? Are you excited for 2019? You know, there's titles being redesigning themselves and changing. How are you feeling about that?
I think that, again, it would be survival of the fittest. I am a very digitally minded person. The Atlantic, I get at home in New York, and I read The Atlantic on paper. Don't ask me why. New York Magazine. I follow a lot of these magazines, and I think it's going to be survival. Survival is going to be good content. It's the same as when people ask me, what will readers pay for? People are going to pay for content that is not just good, excellent. Content that helps them survive, that becomes essential in their lives. The magazines that do this, that really take the next step. And one interesting thing, Fernando, about all of this is that we are, in 2019, we are going to see more interest in longer narratives. I mean, here we are in a situation where people have two movements in terms of the media. They lean forward on the phone 100 times a day, and then they pick a time to lean back and read longer pieces, either during the lunch hour or at night at home. So the reader of today, the reason that doing journalism today is more difficult and more challenging is because you have not only five platforms that you need to do different things for, The way you write for print and edit for print sometimes is the opposite of what you will do on the phone. And you have the ability, to really get your brand out there and present it to people in a variety of ways. All day long, you're updating stories. But many of those stories, I obviously, being Spanish, I would say we deal with tapas, you know, little tapas that get your appetite going. But then you still have to serve the 7-course meal with candles and tablecloth and flowers. And people still want both. They want the snackable little items during the day, and then they will settle and say, I'm going to read that story. But the media house has to make sure that both styles of journalism are presented. And that's the challenge in the transformation of newsrooms. But narratives, long narratives, are the research shows that people are reading long narratives, and those are the pieces that they will pay for. If you go with depth, with analysis, help me survive, become essential in my life.
That was Mario Garcia in conversation with Fernando a little earlier. We head to Taiwan now to hear from Ron Hansen. Ron edits White Fungus, a magazine with interesting roots that's now on its 16th issue. The title covers cultural topics in an array of styles and through a wide critical prism, whether it's the world of animal music or a 50-page interview with American visual artist Carolee Schneeman, it belongs on White Fungus's pages. Ron, it's a pleasure to speak with you. And we've been leafing through, I guess, what have I got here? Issue 16, I think, of White Fungus. Let's roll the clock back a little bit. Tell us a bit about the origin story, because it's really interesting. You and your brother really putting in some miles, traveling around. Obviously, you're sat in and based out of Taiwan now. But let's go back to the start. What was the founding principle, if you like, of White Fungus?
Well, I mean, the whole thing started by accident, really. We'd been living in Taiwan for 4 years in the first 4 years of the previous decade, and had returned to our hometown, Wellington, New Zealand. And we're busy working on music, actually, when we got kicked out of our studio as the building was being turned into more cheap apartments for students visiting the city. And we became involved in a local political movement, which was protesting against the building of an inner city bypass. Now this bypass, which sadly was subsequently built, cut through the city's arts district, demolishing heritage buildings and seeing a number of artist collectives evicted from their studios. And there was a strong protest movement. It had actually been going for 40 years. This road had been successfully resisted. But the mayor of that time, Kerry Prendergast, is married to one of the city's largest property developers, and resistance had ebbed a little bit, and this mayor was just determined to get it through. I mean, she stood to make quite a bit of money from it through her husband's different projects. So we were frustrated, because I had tried writing an article about the local protest movement for a community newspaper, but when I picked up the newspaper, I saw that it had just been edited beyond recognition, and I realized there was just no way of really getting this story through in the local media. So we decided to take matters into our own hands. We produced a small publication on a photocopier. We actually got in touch with a local historian and decided to detail the history of the area that was to be jeopardized. And we profiled the various artist collectives that were being kicked out of their studios, just dealt with the political issue from an arts standpoint. We printed copies on a photocopy machine and wrapped them in Christmas paper and then threw them anonymously through the entrances of businesses throughout the city. And it just created a bit of a stir. A local reporter even was able to get the mayor on the record in response to it, saying something along the lines of, I will not dignify with comment the lies and innuendo contained within White Fungus. So it created a bit of a stir, and we had no plans to continue this publication, but after getting a bit of traction, we decided, well, let's gradually evolve it towards being an arts publication that could deal with our interests in the arts. So it started from very humble beginnings on a very splotchy photocopied. I've often thought of it as being a little bit like punks learning to play their instruments. You know, we started out as a punk band, over many years developed some skills and have actually refined what we're doing, but we still try and keep a little bit of that anarchist DIY spirit in the project.
Well, and Ron, that's really interesting. And I think that that train, that sort of seam clearly runs through. I mean, there's a piece in this 16th issue about the liberation of sound in Taiwan with some really arresting images and a piece by Jeff Lowe, which is really deeply fascinating. Is it important that even if your lens is on that cultural firmament, that the whole piece retains, I don't know, is it important to you and your brother and the rest of the team that it remains political in character in some way?
I mean, we're political by nature and we tend to view things from that point of view. And we've always been interested in artists who deal with political, social or historical content, and we have been since the beginning. I'd have to say that we're probably a little more in line with the current era than when we started. People weren't as interested in that, but it does seem to be a lot more relevant due to the course of the events of the last few years. We think art should get involved in these issues, so we do tend to look for artists who share those concerns.
Let's talk a little bit about publishing, because obviously it's proudly declared, printed in Taiwan, White Fungus on its sort of first cover pages. What's the sort of the business model? Do you find that, you know, as well as being the editor-in-chief, you're a publisher and a bit of a CEO as well? Do you wear that hat gladly? I know that you have obviously lots of other projects that you work with. How much is this a business as well as a publishing and a passion project?
Well, we've gone through a lot of different phases with it and we've gone backwards and forwards, but we've reached a point really where we're decided that this is an artistic project, it's a creative project, and we're not going to worry about the business side of it, which probably sounds crazy to some people, but we got into this because we wanted to explore and experiment and try something new with the form. This issue is probably the first issue where we've just decided to liberate ourselves from any of those commercial expectations and just create exactly the issue that we want to make. Whereas in the past, we've probably made a few more compromises, but this is a completely uncompromising issue. So yeah, we definitely don't do it for money. I mean, we do have a commercial distributor. We're distributed by Boutique Magazines, which is based in London. So we are operating on that level, but if we were really serious about that, then I think about the commercial side of it, then we would take a different approach. We would cover different artists. We would probably try to make it fit into some demographic slots a little easier. We're really at this point, we're to hell with it. This is our creative project, our artistic project, and we want to be able to let it roam where it wants to roam and just see where it ends up.
That was White Fungus editor Ron Hansen. I was going to say that Ron was a fun guy to speak to, but Fernando has banned me from any further dad jokes on this programme, so I can't. Finally, time for a field trip here in London. We're off to visit the iconic travel bookstore Stanford's in its new home. It hasn't moved far, just a stone's throw really across Covent Garden, but to a more modern location. For those who were fans of the shop before, worry not. The selection of books remains bountiful, and of course, their vast collection of globes for sale is still there too. Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco visited the shop, and there he spoke with Stanford's CEO Vivian Godfrey.
The Longacre shop is the fifth home of Stanford's, and this new shop at 7 Mercer Walk is the sixth home. And so I should tell all of our customers that we shouldn't be afraid about moving. Stanford's, since it was founded in 1853, has obviously moved a number of times. But what's important is all of our homes up till now have been near to Covent Garden. And so we're pleased that we're staying near to Covent Garden. One of the things that we looked for in a new location was to try not to be on three floors. Because as a retailer, the more floors you're on, the less efficient you are. Your stock is spread out and our staff are spread out. So we did actually make an offer on another shop that's quite near to here, that's on one floor only, but the owners of the building preferred to choose another tenant. So we were very excited. So we wanted something that was not on three floors, and we managed to find this location that's on two. We also preferred to find a modern building. One of the problems with Longacre is the air conditioning system doesn't work, the heating doesn't work, there's lots of holes. I hate to say this, but there's lots of mice. So all sorts of problems with a really old building that we don't have in a brand new building.
Oh, and you have an amazing outside space as well, which, because, you know, for those who are not here in London, it's kind of a, you know, you can walk around, there's a few restaurants around. It's a new development, right?
It is. This area is owned by the Mercer's company. And actually, they own three blocks that are adjoining each other all along one side of Longacre. And their goal is to create these lovely little pedestrian courtyards. And their first one, St. Martin's Courtyard, is great, and it's got lots of greenery and trees and quite lively, as you say, a nice mixture of retail and restaurants. And then this is their second development, the Mercer Walk, and it's going to, I think, over time it'll evolve. And we've just got permission to put our cafe tables and chairs outside, and that's going to be wonderful for our customers to be able to sit outside. Maybe not today because it's a bit rainy, but you know, in the summer it'll be gorgeous.
And tell us a bit more about your involvement with Stanford's, because your family actually has been quite involved. Explain a little bit the history for us.
Yes, yeah, so my grandfather, Ernest Gordon Godfrey, joined the George Philip Group in 1919. And in 1946, the George Philip Group, which is bigger than Stanford's, bought Stanford's. But from 1946, the Stanford's business operated as an independent unit within the bigger group. Then in 1949, my father joined the company, and both my grandfather and my father in their time were chairman of Stanford's. And I first worked here a long time ago when I was 16 in the summer holidays. I was allowed to come and work at Stanford's. I wasn't allowed to talk to customers. I could only pack up mail orders in the basement. So it's been just over 40 years that I've been involved in the company myself.
How do you think the market have changed? Because, of course, you know, now people, they can check their mobiles when they're traveling. But it's interesting to see the resilience of the travel book. Because I have to be honest, when I travel somewhere, I get confused when I go online. There's so many tips. I mean, who can you trust? So do you think, I mean, the market will be there forever for those who love the printed product, right?
Yes, I think the market will be there. And maybe if we look at the bigger context of the reading of books in general, there was a big growth in digital books when they first arrived, and it grew up to about 8% of the market, and paper books sort of declined, if you like, to 92% of the market. Well, that's now peaked, and electronic books have declined as a proportion of the market. Paper books continue to grow, and the travel sector is definitely a growth area. And I agree with you. I think it can be quite confusing when you're researching things online, and especially some sites that use customer reviews. I'm never really sure if the review was paid for, or did somebody have a grudge against, you know, a hotel that wasn't very nice to them. I'm never really quite sure. So I do think that the authors of travel books, of guidebooks, I do trust them to be independent, and that's why I would always rather use a paper book, and I think travellers like you and I feel the same way about them.
What I like when I go to travel shops to see kind of the travel trends in a way. So for example, I was downstairs checking the travel books. I could see a lot of things about Japan because I know it's a country people are interested. So probably you kind of have to pay attention to that. Are people more interested in Japan, or is it Europe or Brazil? I don't know.
Yes, we do. And we try and pay attention to important events that are happening. And of course, we know the Rugby World Cup and then the Summer Olympics are going to be in Japan. And I'm pretty certain that those two important events are having an impact on people being more interested in Japan. Maybe they haven't planned a trip there yet, but they want to read about it. I personally am a huge fan of Japanese onsen. I love, when I'm in Japan, being able to go to the baths. I remember on my first ever visit there, it was with some trepidation that I went to a public bath, but actually loved the experience. And I'm confident that, as you say, there's a great interest in Japan at the moment. And we do look for those trends, exactly as you say, and try and make sure that we have all of the books and maps in stock.
And I'm very happy to inform our listeners that your globes are still there and they look wonderful in their new section. So and who are your globe suppliers? Are they all coming from all the same producer, or where do you look out for them?
Actually, there has been a growth in the number of different globe manufacturers. For a while, I would say Replogle in the United States perhaps slightly dominated the market, but there are now more smaller different businesses in different parts of the world who are producing interesting globes. You remarked on our globe fixture down in the basement. We are very, very proud of the fact that we have a new globe feature wall, and it particularly allows us to display the illuminated globes. And I would say we're selling more illuminated globes than we ever have. It's just a lovely idea. Instead of having a desk lamp, perhaps, or a night light, you can buy an illuminated globe. And I particularly see people buying them for children. They want their child to have a small night light in their bedroom. And so why have a boring light that plugs into the wall? Why not have a lovely little globe?
Well, in fact, just a few minutes before you arrived, a couple, actually, they bought illuminated globe, and I was just here sitting now. And we're in a lovely cafe as well. I'm glad you had this space as well.
Yes, so the cafe in our current shop in Longacre does very well, and so we've replicated it here. We're going to have slightly fewer inside seats, but because we have this gorgeous courtyard outside, we're going to have lots of outdoor seating. You can see we've got a few sample bits of furniture. We haven't quite decided what style we're going to use, so we're buying some different bits and pieces to test them out.
And finally, Vivian, I'd like to ask this to all my guests. For example, when you go traveling, what do you like to read on the plane? Are you kind of a book person or magazines, or you just like to rest?
I am totally a magazine and newspaper person on the plane. I load up my very large handbag, which you see here. I actually save things up from the prior week or two so that I can take them with me and, read the magazines and newspapers I might not otherwise.
That was Vivian Godfrey from Stanford's talking to Fernando in Stanford's new store. And that's all for this week's programme. Thanks to our producer, Fernando Augusto Pacheco. He's been busy this week. And our editor, Cassie Galpin. Comments or queries or suggestions are welcome. Send them to Fernando on fp@monocle.com. And don't forget to join us at the same time next week. Now, before we go, a little song for you to listen to on the road, on the plane, while reading your travel book. Whatever your globetrotting looks like, this is the perfect soundtrack. Of course, it's Iggy Pop with The Passenger. This is The Stack. I'm Tom Edwards. Thanks for listening.
I am a passenger. I stay under glass.